accession number 19666, Reel 3.
Sam Shepherdson, Reel 3. You were just about to tell me about a second Japanese prisoner.
The second Japanese prisoner I saw, we didn't take this particular man, but he was much higher rank than the little chap we took. And he sat in this clearing. They made a cage to put him in. And he sat on a mat, cross-legged, all day, staring in front of himself. And I've never forgotten that. Perhaps I should mention this area close to where he was. There were lots of American airmen in that area, remnants of Colonel Cochrane's squadron. Jackie Coogan was one of them, although he wasn't there when I was there. We often used to guard the forward airstrip of this particular squadron of Americans who used to fly in supplies and ferry out wounded. And we were standing to one night around the edges of this airstrip. The dusk was coming down, and we thought this plane had landed. And all of a sudden, there was a great bang, and the whole plane exploded and went up in flames. And we went over to it and got out as many of these American airmen as we could, but one, alas, was left inside. And most of them were badly burned, and indeed burning, put that out. And we took them in our company jeep, and at this stage, the monsoon had largely finished and you could still drive along, to a casualty clearing station supplied by Belgian Congo soldiers. There weren't only British soldiers there. And all the way down to this largely black-staffed casualty clearing station, one of the Americans in the jeep lying there kept moaning and saying, "Don't take me to a British hospital. Take me to an American hospital. Don't take me." And we kept saying, "Okay, pal, we're going to take you to a British hospital." And he was a deep southerner. What he would have said when he finally recovered proper consciousness and found out he landed up in a black-staffed Belgian Congo casualty clearing station, I do not know. I had other experiences of American white southern airmen and their mores. One of the airmen who used to come in, I got to know quite well, was named Chambers, and he came from Oklahoma, which is in fact a southern state, although most people don't recognize it as one. And he looked around at our askari, waiting to go on patrols or guarding this general who was a prisoner of war, and he said, "Gee, Sam, if only our niggers were like your fellas, there wouldn't be any problems in America." So I remember that one. After the war, I became quite interested in American race relations and did a personal tour of the South, and these sort of things helped. I should mention, perhaps before I go any further, that the one thing that I found most impressive in my time in Burma, I wrote 750 words about it in John Nunnally's book, and this was the Japanese dead at Tamu, on the entrance to the Kabul Valley. And of course, General Slim did a piece too, wonderful piece, in his Defeat into Victory. And it was there that I wrote a couple of poems, one of which got broadcast on the BBC. I can only remember the first verse, which went, as a matter of fact, it went, it's gone from my head at the moment, it may come back.
But did you see these Japanese dead yourself?
Oh yes, oh yes, terrifying. All lying at the foot of Buddhas, with stinking to high heaven, and mills in with them, all in the stage of rotting.
Why should they have been at the foot of Buddhas?
They crawl to these Buddhas, presumably. "Oh, temples now in Tamu, tumbled down, and men and mules mouldy everywhere, death smelly, separating from the ground, and putrefaction sighing in the air, or poisoning the air." About six verses going on like that. I was very much of an admirer during the war. I got news of his death that came in the newspaper, SEAC, which was dropped with supplies by parachute, of the late Alan Lewis, the Welsh poet, who was killed in the Arakan. But The Tamu experience was really quite shocking, in the very fact that William Slim wrote about a page on Tamu shows that I wasn't just a sentimental young man who was worried by seeing dead Japanese.
So what was your own attitude towards the enemy?
I had no strong feelings, except that we knew that they were often brutal. And there was a strong rumour floating around in the 11th East African Division that the Japanese had said that any white man found leading barbaric black soldiers against them would be put brutally to death. And I heard, and this is only hearsay evidence, that one officer, white officer, was captured by the Japanese, and they spread-eagled him in a chong, that's a dried-up stream bed, and left him there to die. But of course his comrades got there and released him before he died. That was a rumour that went around. I have heard people saying that this can't be so, but I would be prepared to believe it. What did strike me a lot, though, about the Japanese that I saw second-hand were these little Japanese diaries, when you could see, although I don't know any Japanese, little poems being written, haiku, tanka. You could see people doing bits of elementary French in them. That sort of thing never happened in the British Army. We may have had ABCA, you know, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, but that was only pouring left-wing ideas into the soldiers to elect Labour in the 1946 election. My other general experience of the 11th East African Division, which was, of course, the first group ever to advance through a monsoon, as Gerald Hanley pointed out in Monsoon Victory. But the people who stood up best to it were not the big, tough, regular soldiers. Many of them went down, most remarkably, with things like crutch rot, and going around with their private parts all plastered over with gentian violet. The people who kept going, well, those had a certain amount of stamina. Now, I went through the whole thing at that campaign, and I must have had a lot of stamina because I did a hell of a lot of walking under all sorts of conditions, but towards the end it was getting me down because I developed a boil in the middle of my back, and I was advancing with our platoon, and I'd got full pack. I got a steel helmet on the pack. I'd got two grenades on the belt. I'd got two Bren gun pouches. I'd got about 150 rounds of ammunition. I got a revolver, ammunition for that, and also got a rifle, because after my experiences with the Sten gun, I wasn't going to trust them any longer. And I almost collapsed, and all this lot was pressing down on the boil that was coming in the middle of my back. And I had to give my rifle to an askari to carry, and I got into a casualty clearing station, and there was just one African medical orderly there, and he squeezed the boil with his thumbs. It all came out. But 15 minutes later, we had an airdrop, and we had some mail. And my cousin in Lowestoft, who has now reached the glorious age of 91, she used to send me little parcels of books and things, and she'd put in this parcel a tin of Del Monte fruit cocktail. And I can assure you that having had my boil squeezed like that, to eat Del Monte fruit cocktail was one of heaven's anticipations. I never go for a shop that sells Del Monte fruit cocktail nowadays, but that I don't buy one. Well, although I was pretty run down at that time, we got across the Chin Ring, which was an amazing experience, because at that time it was the largest Bailey Bridge in the world, and we got to the other side, and there were all the British guns and old cars which had been left in the retreat of 1942. And as soon as our Nyasa soldiers, who were very unsophisticated people, saw them, they went, sat in these old cars and pretended they were driving them, and got on these old guns and pretended they were firing them. It was almost like a kid's park. But that was then the time when the last patrol of the KR, the 11th East African Division, took place. And I was one of the people who went out with that under battalion second in command, Major Willie Spur. And I think I probably did the last piece. We got to find out if there were any Japanese sweeping the right flank of the British 2nd Division, which had come in after rest from Kohima, to carry on to Mandalay. And I went out with my platoon, and I thought to myself, it was not far off Christmas Day. Well, it would be pretty grim and ironic if I bought it on this patrol, having got this far. And we went down this Chong, this small river, which at that time was just dust because the monsoon had stopped. I don't know how many months of monsoon we had, but we had several. It must have been about three, possibly four. And we got on the left side of this Chong, and then we got across it. And there was obviously a possibility of something on the other side. So I said, look, you know, it wasn't very good, Nyanja. Tizi Zungulira. We was walk over in a wave-like motion, you know what I mean, and run over. And we got, this must have been about 50 yards across, which is far enough. And I thought, as we got over there, well, if anything happens now, this is just about it. But we got over on the other side, and then just inside the jungle, there was a small bunker, which had probably been vacated a few hours before that. So I survived that one. And then my platoon, which was, I don't know, perhaps 15 miles away from the firm base of the Tiki Force, as this reconnaissance fighting patrol was called, we got back to our base. And Major Spur called me to him and said, is anybody there, Sam? I said, no, I had no signs of anybody. I think they may have been 3 days ago, but they've gone. So we all went to bed around the, with sentries out, around the pagoda where we were based. And in the morning, Major Spur called me to him. He said, what's all this bloody business about no Japanese being around? What's this? And he took me a few yards, and there was a trail of Japanese footprints coming into the camp. I said, I can explain this one, sir. I said, when we got to that bunker, one of the members of my patrol found a pair of Japanese jungle boots, and he preferred them to his own, so he put them on. He said, well, the fuck, I can get rid of them. And that was my last memory of that patrol, of which I've shown you the intelligence map I made up on it. And after that, we went down the Chindwin in boats and we crossed it. Unfortunately, I've lost a drawing I made of the Burma bank of the Chindwin, not the one that faces India, which contained a Japanese obelisk that they'd put up saying the gateway to the west is now open, because they thought they were going to get India. And from there, we went back into the jungle on Christmas Day, where they brought up a cinema screen and showed us of all films the gentle sex about the ATS. Particularly sad memory, because Africans from Malawi, which is a largely Christianized country, our Scottish missionaries, always kept Christmas Day, and there was no sort of treat for them at all. But by that time, the trails were open, and some very public-spirited young ladies from somewhere on the Burma-India border had brought up a naffy van, so I gave my platoon a very curious Christmas Day. All I could buy was two large glass jars of boiled sweets for them. And that was all I could get. But before we went back to Dimapur for further training, we were employed for a few days in building General Slim's headquarters, where I had the curious experience of seeing the Burmese cutting up a dead elephant, and one man taking the trunk over his shoulder, because this is said to be the best one. We then flew out, and we flew back to Dimapur, where we were training for a while, and after that we went further back to Ranchi in Bihar. We were there for quite a while. And I gather that the reason why we didn't put us back into action quickly was because General Slim was not particularly satisfied with the 11th East African Division. I have, in fact, seen a confidential document about this, which an American researcher in the Public Record Office managed to copy. He shouldn't, but he brought it back. There had been, with some of the KR battalions, reluctance to go into action. Not all of them, but occasionally. And I mentioned the two episodes when I saw African soldiers trying to kill Europeans. The Uganda soldiers had caused trouble. They wouldn't cross the Chindwin. They said, we've gone far enough. We didn't want to come out for this. And Slim, although he eventually said in his book some kind words about the KR, and so he should have done, because they endured great physical privations, putting back the teaching Japanese, he was reluctant to use them. But at the end of the war, they were going to put us back into action. And I, at that time, had been transferred to the mortar platoon, and I was learning the 3-inch mortar. And we got about, so we were told, about 10 days or so before we went back into action. That would have been somewhere in the south, in the Mulmine region. And, of course, they dropped the bomb. So we didn't go back. We stayed where we were. And the African soldiers were on educational programs. We had a certain amount of training in quelling civil disobedience in case there should be any Bolshevistically minded Gandhians in the area. And I always felt very sad that I came out on Class B release, because I was originally contracted to train as a school teacher. They wanted school teachers. And I flew out from Karachi, and it took 7 days to get home in an ancient Dakota from Karachi, and I did not go back by sea with our Nyasa troops to East Africa. But in a visit to what's now called Malawi after the war, I met one of our European sergeant majors, and he said they'd had a lot of discontent on the ship on the way back because they felt they'd been overseas for too long. And personally, I have some sympathy with that discontent, because if you were an ordinary African tribesman, the little inconspicuous village in Malawi, or Nyasaland as you used to call it, and you'd probably been part of the KR that went up into East Africa and up into Abyssinia and helped defeat the Italians, as many of them were, and then you had spent a lot of time training in East Africa and Ceylon and India, and you'd gone on this arduous advance through the Kabul Valley, just as liable to get malaria as any European, although you had proper malaria pills. And when you came out of action, you couldn't take proper leave. You couldn't go as a white English or Scottish soldier could go to Calcutta or something like that. One thing, you didn't get enough money. And the arrangements were made for leave camps at Mariani. I've shown you a photograph of my African orderly, which I had taken in Mariani. There was this discontent. I can always remember one of our lance corporals who came to us later. When we were in Dimapur, he got the military medal in Burma, Lance Corporal Amidou. And he said to me, why don't we get paid as much as a British soldier? And I cooked up some explanation to maintain morale, saying, well, when you get better educated, no doubt King George will raise your wages. And he said, Bwana, it takes one bullet to kill a black soldier and one bullet to kill a white soldier. Chipolopolo Chimudzi, one bullet. I've always remembered that, but I think if one looks back over the history of the 11th East African Division, General Slim was right to subdue his doubts and to give them praise in the defeat into victory, because that advance under very, very difficult conditions was very arduous indeed, and particularly for young men who had never been overseas before. I hadn't, but at least I knew what overseas meant. Since then, I have seen some of our old askari in Malawi. Life hasn't treated them too well. Most of them are dead by now, since the average age of Nyasaland, or perhaps an East African soldier, was about 45, 50 at the most. They didn't live to be 90, to Dr. Bando, who helped to keep himself alive. I could say a great deal more.
Please do.
Pardon?
Please do.
Well, I, as I say, wrote and kept in a little book various poems. Some have been published. One's in the Penguin Anthology of War Poetry. But I did write two, actually, almost on the spot, And I had one extremely curious experience when we were, I should say, about 20 miles from Kalewa. That was the town on the Chindwin, which was a European town with, you know, DCs and settlers living before the war. And that was captured by the KAR and Indian troops and used as the basis for building the Bailey Bridge across the Chindwin. And we were up a rather steep hill in the jungle. And I had a, this isn't a particularly good poem, but the circumstances in which it came out are rather curious. I was sleeping in small weapon pit by myself in the morning, and I woke up at the dawn. And as I woke up, I had the feeling that the Japanese was leaning over me, about to bayonet me. And it was rather like Coleridge writing Kubla Khan, the first 30 lines. And it stopped. And this floated out of my head, at least the first three verses non-stop, and I wrote the last one more consciously. I called it Jungle Nightmare Near Kalewa, Burma, 1944. Who will be with you in your loneliness when you are rotting in the grassy grave? He leered, his face, mask of maliciousness, so near to mine, murderous and depraved. Then I awoke. It was a dream, stupid but natural dream of the enemy at war. Figures of death, vicious, vapid, phantasms of mind for death unready. But this one was so real. He seemed to be the figure of time himself, pitiless. I, asleep in a trench, felt I lay in the grave, he so merciless. Dawn, dreams forgotten, life and happiness, but through my mind his words relentless rave. Who will be with you in your loneliness when you are rotting in the grassy grave? And the first three verses came straight out. I wrote a second one about a mile and a half up the road on the hillside in about 20 minutes. And this is in blank verse, and this is a general one. But it's called Circumstance, 11 and a half miles from the Chindwin crossing at Kalewa, 1944. Which might be an appropriate point to end, unless you've got any particular points you want me to expatiate on. In your quiet homes, my friends, remember us tonight, who sleep with danger, not with love. We are not heroes, and we do not wait the order into battle eagerly, preferring that another do the job and we alive with them to mourn their dead. But if that order comes, then go we must, and if we die, we die. That's that. How sad, brave lads, heroes all, the cinemas and papers say. You know differently. You are flesh, small and weak like us. It is the after years of action make us say, I'm glad I fought. I wouldn't have stayed at home. Ask any man now on the assault line if he would exchange bar boastings to be for present comfort and security. You know you are flesh small and weak like us. But circumstance has set us here. We are forced to become heroes or dead men, and you to sleep in your quiet, pleasant homes. Therefore, my friends, my fortunate ones, it is fair, it is charitable for you tonight, before you turn to rest, to remember us unfortunate ones of circumstance, who would be with you in your comfort, but must sleep tonight with danger, not with love. Now, that's a white man feeling the campaign, summing it up. Although the Nyanja and Swahili languages rhyme easily, there's some verse in Swahili, but there's hardly any in Nyanja. There were a number of fairly well-educated Africans with us, although most of them were illiterate. And why did they not produce poems? Malawi has produced one internationally famous poet who's living in this country, Jack Mapanji. Why couldn't they produce people like that? I think the answer was that any poetic feeling about the war, about the Japanese, about the jungle, went into Askari songs. And I would like to make my last anecdote. When we came out of Burma, crossing into India, we marched, we had a little motor transport, but most of it was going to take the second British Div through us into central Burma. And one night, we marched through the night, and my African orderly, whose picture I've shown you, Austin Chikapa, alas now dead in Malawi, I think he must have sung for at least 7 or 8 hours without stopping. There's a recording of the sort of songs he sung in a group of records which were made after the war in Calcutta by Columbia, and the KAR Regimental Association has done a cassette of that, but nothing can recapture the way this man sang. And the sort of doubts that I indicated in that poem are in his singing, in the melody, in the sort of counterpoint that the fellows marching with them made, the sort of singing that this choir that's travelling around from Soweto give. And I wrote a piece for the Malawi Journal, Journal of Society of Malawi, some years ago, on war poetry from Nyasaland during the First and Second World Wars, and why there was so little of it, and why nothing came out of Africans. Not poetry as we know it, but real poetry, because when poetry began, it was obviously sung and chanted and not just read aloud in a somewhat parsonic manner, as I've done at the moment. I could say quite a lot more about this. I could say things about sexual problems, black and white homosexuality manifesting itself. I've seen a little of that. It's not pleasant.
Tell me about these then.
Pardon?
Tell me about this type of thing.
Well, I remember that when we came out of action, we went back to Dimapur. You know, I've heard of Dimapur, I'm sure. A lot of training. And one of our officers, a reinforcement posted to us, was cohabiting with an African sergeant, and the African sergeant split on him. And he was called up for court-martial. Of course, it's very difficult to prove these things, so the story went round that the brigadier in charge of the court-martial said, "We can't prove anything on you, but as far as I'm concerned, you're a dirty bugger, and I'm sending you to a British battalion." It's perhaps the great story of the sexual problems and the war in Burma is told in more recent scholarship about Alan Lewis. Did Lewis die accidentally in the Arakan, slip down a hill and shoot himself with his revolver, or did he kill himself? And there's a growing school of opinion that thinks he probably killed himself, because he'd only been married shortly before he left Britain for Burma. And then he had an affair with a fairly well holstered upper-class English woman, and he was not upper-class, he was a real old-fashioned boy from the valleys, and the stories that hung on his conscience and may have caused him to shoot himself, I don't know. But in all these sort of things that are made about the war, you very rarely get anything about sexual experiences. We had a European regimental sergeant major. We had two regimental sergeant majors, one European, one African. And this chap was always trying to seduce the young officers.